One down, 51 weeks to go. How do you suppose are we doing so far, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, 7 January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know I say that all the time, but I honestly do mean it. It has been a week. This one has the first week back after the holidays. Omicron in full force yesterday, of course, 6 January. And cherry on top, economic news as always. Catherine Rampell's at the Washington Post. Kate Davidson's at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. I will point out the numbers of the day. 3.9% on the unemployment rate. That's down more than a little bit. 199,000 new jobs added to the economy last month. Disappointing, but, you know, it's kind of a 4x average. I would like to point out, though, and get your thoughts on this point, that the labor market has come back amazingly fast, amazingly far. What do you think?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Definitely, it has come back more quickly than had been forecast a year ago, 2 years ago, let's say, or, you know, around the start of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But we're still very deeply in the hole. If you look at just how many jobs there are today versus in February of 2020, we're missing over 3 million jobs. Mm-hmm. If you consider how many jobs had been predicted to exist around this time, if you look at like Congressional Budget Office forecasts from before the pandemic, et cetera, it's more than 5 million jobs in terms of a shortfall. So yes, we have come back relatively quickly, particularly in regards to the track record after the last mm-hmm, recession, mm-hmm. the Great Recession. But it's not like we're in a market that has healed. There's still a long way to go.
Do you suppose, Kate, that sort of accounts for what I think Justin Ho said in a piece yesterday was the great disconnect between what the economy actually is, which, you know, not so bad. We're missing the jobs, but the economy's not so bad, and how people are feeling about it and their prospects, which is not great.
Perhaps. I mean, of course, I think a lot of people would point to prices mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you know, their inflation has been in the headlines for months, of course, and prices really have gone up noticeably. They've gone up a lot. Grocery bills, gas, which is, you know, easing somewhat. But I mean, I think that's part of the feeling. But it's hard to see. I mean, when you look at the labor market and what's happening with wages and the data that we see about job openings and the quits rate is at a record high, that's suggesting that people are leaving their jobs because they feel like their prospects elsewhere are really good. And the wage gains we've seen have gone, you know, more to workers in hourly jobs. Yep. So those tend to be lower wage workers. So, you know, right. You would think that people would feel pretty confident about where the labor market is at. And yet there is this disconnect. So I'm not sure. Right. Maybe, you know, as Catherine points out, there are still millions of jobs missing. And there surely are people out there who can't find jobs, but so, I don't know how, I don't know. The reasons are confusing.
Yeah. No, well, look, and we should be clear. This is a very confusing economy, and that's not just the three of us saying it. It's everybody out there. But Catherine, let me ask you this. We got the Federal Reserve minutes of their December meeting when it became clear that they are serious about withdrawing support for this economy. That is to say, raising rates. And also they're talking seriously about running down their $9 trillion balance sheet. If the job market is so still in the hole, as Chair Powell says all the time, how come we're looking at like a March-ish beginning of what people call liftoff, right? Raising interest rates.
Well, because it is recovering, as we've just discussed, it does seem like there are a lot of openings out there. The problem is luring workers into those openings. Mm-hmm. So the job market, you know, is doing pretty well, even if it's not where we'd like it to be. And then there's the other half of the Fed's dual mandate, of course, which is mm-hmm. stable prices. They want maximum employment and stable prices. And that's where the Fed is much more concerned. That's the reason why they've grown more hawkish, why they seem to have pulled forward their expected timeline for, you know, at the very least, taking their foot off of the accelerator and maybe slamming on the brakes at some point, or at mm-hmm. least tapping the brakes, because they're worried about inflation getting out of control. And so, you know, they have to balance these somewhat competing goals. And if the market looks healthy enough, the job market looks right. healthy enough to withstand a little bit less monetary help, then they're probably more likely to err on the side of worrying about inflation. And that's why we would see the Fed potentially running down its balance sheet as well as eventually raising rates.
Yeah. Kate, super quick process detour next week. Jay Powell has his renomination hearing, and Lael Brainard will have hers on Thursday for the vice chair job. We're not expecting any surprises, right?
Well, I don't think so. Although, I mean, we got news again yesterday about sort of more into this, more details on this trading scandal at the Fed of, a few months back, which you may recall. It seems that Vice Chairman Rich Clarida didn't fully disclose some trades he made at the time. I think that's bad for Powell. I just think it's going to raise questions. Certainly Elizabeth Warren's probably going to ask, what else do we not know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's going to push, her calls for a fuller investigation. So that's not great. But I think beyond that, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, they're going to want to know, when are you going to raise rates? That's the big question.
Yeah. All right. So let's turn from the tangible economic stuff, Catherine, to the intangibles. And I want to roll with me on this one. You wrote a column, I don't know, I read it when I was off, so it was probably 10 days, 2 weeks ago maybe, about, I'm paraphrasing here, but about your fatigue in this economy and in this society with the pandemic, and how you'd started to cry some more in public, and you decided you're okay with that. And I'll fess up here, I'm crying a lot these days too, because it's hard. Make this turn for me to fatigue in this economy as we enter what's going to be year three come the 11th of March, which seems just crazy.
We're all exhausted. We're all burnt out. I will point out that the piece that you're referring to talked about how I was crying about happy things.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, you're totally right.
So,
yes.
But maybe that's because I'm repressing all the, the sadness and angst
you and me both.
Of the world. I think people are really run down emotionally and otherwise. You see it in the jobs numbers, I mean, among other things, people need, or some people are taking a break from the workforce for a little while. You see it in how people interact with each other and, short tempers at the airport. There are clearly lots of indicators that this pandemic is wearing on us as a society. Understandably, people are just stressed out, burnt out, cooped up. I wish we were seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. It feels like we've seen that several times in the past, and then a new variant came along. Yeah. I think the most optimistic thing we can think about is just, we're getting more shots in arms. People are getting boosted. As long as we do what we can to try to keep the virus at bay, that will reduce the likelihood of further disruptions, economically and otherwise, and hopefully get us to some sort of equilibrium where we can live with this thing. Maybe coronavirus will be with us in some form forever. I don't know, but maybe it'll be more manageable, and we'll all feel a little bit of that weight off of our shoulders. I hope so.
I think in the meantime, we're just going to keep buying stuff to make ourselves feel better.
That's right.
Unfortunately,
that little
so.
Dopamine right. rush of the
right.
click. Yeah.
Yay, American right. consumers. Oh, my goodness. Kate Davidson writes the Morning Money column at Politico. And Catherine Appel writes a bunch of stuff. And it's all really good at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street on this Friday, I guess traders are tired, too, because it was kind of meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, a little bit more now on jobs. A dispatch from the marketplace desk of Cognitive Dissonance. On the one hand, the headline number, as we say, was just 199,000. As I mentioned, less than half of what all the experts and know-it-alls had been guessing, and less than November's actually revised number of about 250,000 jobs. On the other hand, as economists like to say, the unemployment rate has dropped again, as I pointed out, by a not insignificant 0.3% to 3.9%, which is close to as low as it got before the pandemic. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains, this is a tale of two data sets.
Actually, it's a tale of two different employment surveys that are combined together to form the monthly jobs report. Heidi Shierholz was chief economist at the Labor Department during the Obama administration.
The survey that gets maybe the most attention is the total number of jobs added, and that is from the establishment survey. Businesses are asked, how many people do you have on payroll? So that's how we get this count of the total number of jobs in the economy.
But that can't tell us how many people don't have jobs. For that, there's a separate survey.
The household survey, where survey takers ask people, are you working? Are you looking for work? And it's from that survey that we get the unemployment rate.
In December, employers said they added 200,000 payroll jobs, but about 650,000 more people reported that they were working, and that helped push the unemployment rate down. Now, these surveys do diverge sometimes. There can be faulty seasonal adjustment, bad response rates, but there is a difference in how the surveys define employment. The establishment survey basically just counts people who get a paycheck for working for an employer. But Bill Rogers at the St. Louis Federal Reserve says the household survey also includes
people who are in agriculture, who are working in an unincorporated self-employment situation, workers in private households such as nannies or housekeepers working under the table.
And that's significant right now, says Mike Fratantoni at the Mortgage Bankers Association.
Individuals who are self-employed or have some spots in the gig economy, people, you know, working a little bit on the side, I think that's a positive for the economy.
Fratantoni says the slow pace at which employers are adding jobs right now might just indicate how hard it is to find and hire workers rather than weakness in the economy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Getting just a touch more expensive to take out a mortgage in this economy. Freddie Mac said this week that the average rate on a 30-year fixed has bumped up to 3.22%. Yes, that is still very, very low. Don't at me. But this time last year, you could have borrowed for 30 years fixed at a record low 2.65%. And it turns out for those in the market for a second home, costs are going up even more, as Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
Demand for second homes has gone through the roof in the last couple of years as newly remote workers seek more space and better scenery. But Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin, says it's not just the pandemic.
There is a long-term trend that we've seen of second home purchases increasing. I think part of that just goes along with wealth inequality and the rich getting richer and being able to buy more second homes.
Soon, they'll have to pay a little more for those homes. This week, the Federal Housing Finance Agency announced it's increasing the upfront fees for second home loans sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by as much as about 3.9% starting in April. Redfin estimates that'll cost a typical buyer an extra $13,500 on a $400,000 home. Fairweather says regulators may be trying to get a handle on what could be an emerging bubble in the housing market.
If a whole lot of people are buying up second homes with the belief that it's a great investment because the value will only go up, that can turn into bubble behavior.
Fees will also go up on certain high balance loans, with exceptions for first-time buyers. Guy Sakala with Inside Mortgage Finance says Fannie and Freddie have a mission to help make homeownership more affordable. Propping up the market for second homes isn't exactly helping.
They should be focusing their resources on low and moderate income borrowers, and that's the reason for doing it.
Demand for second homes is likely to remain high, says Dean Tucker, a mortgage broker in Boise, Idaho.
I don't think that it's going to slow that market down. Second home buyers are typically more affluent, and if that's what the cost of getting a second home, that's the cost.
Buyers can always borrow in the private market, and a lot of them don't even need a mortgage. They pay cash. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
putting a basic highlight across the top of the head.
I have no idea what that means, but okay. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's basically flat on this Friday, 36,231. The NASDAQ down 144, that's 0.9%, 14,935. The S&P 500 down 19 points, 0.4%, 46.77. For the week, the Dow Industrial's down nearly 0.3%. The NASDAQ had a terrible week, off 4.5%. S&P 500 down 0.8%. Heard from Mitchell about jobs, right? So in staffing stocks, Korn Ferry dropped 7.3% today. HireQuest down 2.4%. Amy was talking about mortgages and federal rules. Home browsing stocks then. Redfin closed down 4% today. Zillow dipped 1.4%. Got to do bonds, given what the conversation is about interest rates. Prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.76%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back to jobs we go because they are where it's at in this economy right now. And I want to direct your attention to one part of today's December jobs report that we have not yet talked about.
You have to scroll all the way down, all the way down. There's lots of numbers. There's lots of statistics.
That's Veronica Dollar. She's an assistant professor at SUNY Old Westbury.
And I'm a labor economist.
The place her scroll stopped is on something called the diffusion index. We have talked about it once or twice, I think.
And I think it's actually quite a bit of fun. It can be very useful. It's a very, very quick snapshot in terms of what's happening in the economies.
All right. Fun? I don't know. But this morning's headline number, 199,000 new jobs, as we've said, tells you how many jobs were added to this economy. The diffusion index, on the other hand, measures breadth, how diffusely those jobs are scattered across industries.
So if you look at an index and you're seeing really, really large numbers, let's say 100 or close to, you know, high 90s, that basically indicates that the increase in employment is really widespread.
A number over 50 means more industries gained jobs than lost them.
Or a low index basically indicates if the employment growth was really concentrated within few industries.
Okay, so today's diffusion index?
59.5,
the lowest it's been since January 2021.
I mean, the good news is still that the number is above 50.
Yeah, the bad news is it's not closer to 100, right?
That basically means that this employment growth is really focused on only few industries.
You can guess which ones. Leisure and hospitality gained 53,000 jobs last month. Professional and business services up 43,000.
Within two super sectors, you can get almost 50% of the increase in employment numbers that we are basically seeing.
This economy created more jobs in 2021 than in any year on record, but that is from a pretty low start. And as Catherine said up at the top of the program, we are still down more than 3.5 million jobs from the before times. Thanks again to Veronica Dollar at SUNY Old Westbury in New York. New year, new laws. Y'all know how it goes, right? As of January the 1st, payment apps, think Venmo and PayPal and Zelle, they have to report business transactions totaling more than $600 a year to the Internal Revenue Service. Before, it used to be the business owners and freelancers who were supposed to self-report their income, and the threshold was a lot higher. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes a look at the change and the consequences.
When Venmo first started, it was mostly used to split bills for things like dinner or utilities between friends and family. Now?
Hairdressers, dog walkers, financial consultants.
Jonathan Meadows is a CPA for independent contractors in New York City. He says about half his clients use digital payment platforms in lieu of checks and credit cards, or cash.
The old days of taking $20 and putting it in your pocket are long gone.
Cash and now apps make it easier for people to illegally underreport their earnings. Caroline Bruckner is managing director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University. She says the IRS wants to collect on that, especially now that the labor force has shifted.
As a result of the Great Resignation, it's not that people aren't working. It's just that many people are starting to work for themselves.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics expects the number of self-employed workers to continue growing and faster than the rate projected for job growth overall. Of course, not everyone's going to love this new rule. Lisa Ellis is a payments analyst at MoffittNathanson.
Business owners, you know, who prefer to operate in a cash environment, let me put it that way, kind of may try to shift back in that direction to a certain extent.
But she doubts customers will shift back to cash with them, especially during a pandemic that's helped solidify digital transactions. And she says it'll be hard for business owners to get around the law. The platforms are being held responsible, so they'll create more back-end features to convince people to make business-specific accounts and prompt you as a customer to categorize payments. Plus, there's always AI.
They can tell, right, based on the activity in your wallet, if you're a business. Like, let's be honest, they can tell.
Especially if I keep adding that little haircut emoji to my stylist's tip. I'm Kristen Schwab from Marketplace.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics has its ways of tracking jobs in this economy, and that is fine. It's okay. We, though, have ours. Our series, The United States of Work. 10 people, 10 different kinds of jobs in this economy and how they have changed. Ashley Nelson is an independent hairstylist. She's up in Boise, Idaho.
This year in business in 2021 has been actually thriving more than I expected. I kind of expected people to stay home and want to like keep their money and save their money, but it seems like more people are out trying to enjoy the best of life. Everything that sits in my chair recently has been huge projects, so lots of transformations, whether it's chopping off all the hair and going into a short bob, or it's going from dark brown hair to now more of a golden blonde, or I have had quite a few clients transition from gray coverages to trying to grow out their natural hair. So there's a lot more creativity you have to bring to the table versus just putting a basic highlight across the top of the head. The supply chain has been really slow and the prices across the board have gone up on everything. The cost of just an individual box of color, the developer, and then the way that the trends have changed over the last few years with just more lived-in colors and looks that last longer, it takes and requires a lot more product usage. So the shortage comes across the board with literally every single product. Starting in this year in 2022, there will be a price increase for my services because that has to cover the cost of all the prices going up. I definitely was trying to be mindful of people's situations in 2021, and I think I gave everybody enough time to do that. So I'm excited to move forward this next year and hopefully continue to keep growing my business.
The supply chain is everywhere, people. We keep telling you that. Ashley Nelson there in Boise, one of the 10 that we've been following in our series, The United States of Work. This final note on the way out today, which I believe gets filed in the Of Course They Are folder. GameStop, it of the meme stock frenzy of last year, is getting into the NFT racket, so reports the Wall Street Journal today. NFTs, of course, as we've said, those unique digital things, pictures, artwork, what have you, that are increasingly popular and expensive. The company says the journal is going to let people buy and sell NFTs around video games, weapons, for instance, avatar outfits. Yet another in the growing you spend real money for virtual stuff category. All right, we're out, but here's your moment of economic context. Comes to us courtesy of Citigroup, which said today that in accordance with a policy it first announced back in October, that if employees aren't fully vaxxed by January 31st, they are going to be shown the door of the first big Wall Street bank to draw that line. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.